Good evening. Happy Shabbat to everyone. Welcome to Yada Yah Radio. My pleasure to be with you. We have James and Larry with us. Hi, guys. Uh-oh, I don't hear anybody.
We were muted. I got it.
Oh, you were. That was my fault. I'm usually pretty quick to push the red button. You know, when you're old, you don't become quite as efficient to doing things as when you're younger. I'm going to blame it on that. We have four different things to potentially go over today. I want to begin with a question that Marcella sent. Marcella is in the chat room. Many of you know her. She's works as a dentist in Mexico. I think it's more beyond just being a dentist, but excuse me if I have understated your profession, but I know that you work in dentistry in Mexico. Marcella is the person who has translated virtually everything that we've written into Spanish, and God bless her. She's gone back through now, and with all the changes to all these books, is once again translating them into Spanish, including Questioning Paul. So I do want to thank her for doing that. I see William is also someone who is not hearing effectively, and that he says he does not hear the show either. To answer Marcella's question, which was she wanted to know more about Masoret, which is an interesting subject because it has so much bearing on not only the question that William has, but overall, how can we trust, how can we also decipher what God has told us? Everyone probably knows that there are that the primary text for what is called the Old Testament, this would be the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, the acronym that Jews use would be Tanakh, is the Masoretic. Most do not know when the Masoretes first emerged on the scene, but the oldest Masoretic text is the Codex Linogratus. It was from the 11th century. It was found in the 16th or 17th century, but was not published and therefore publicly available until the 19th century. So when someone says, you know, that a old translation is based on the Masoretic, they would be deceiving anyone who would believe them. You would have to have a translation that was conceived in the 20th century to have it be based on even a remotely reliable Masoretic manuscript, which would be the Codex Linogratus, because that's when it was published. The Masoretic text is was based upon vocalizing the Babylonian text. There are two dramatically different families of the text of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms. One of those is the text that were written and maintained within Yisrael. And that body of information we have only had access to publicly for about a decade or so, although the texts themselves were first uncovered in the 1950s. And that's the Qumran or Dead Sea Scrolls. They show the Yisraelite textual history, and they're called as a family of text where they were all maintained and transcribed inside of Yisrael. Then there is the Masoretic family, which is a Babylonian text. And if you know twice, once for the northern kingdom into Assyria, and then secondarily Yehuda into Babylon, that the Israelites were carried off into slavery. Well, a lot of Israelites chose to stay in Babylon. In fact, they didn't come out of Babylon until they were, until they were kicked out following the 1948 establishment of Israel as a nation, when the Iranians and the Iraqis said, we don't want you here. Go away. Leave everything behind. You can't take anything with you, but get out of here or we'll kill you. And so it was for the better part of 2,500 years that the Jews maintained a collection of manuscripts in Babylon. And it's even where we transition from the ancient Hebrew scripts, the Paleo-Hebrew scripts, to the Babylonian script that we see so prevalent today. Well, with that knowledge that the Masoretic text is from the Babylonian family, and Babylonian, every time we say Babylonian, of course, there's a pejorative associated with it, God hates Babylon. And even though it was maintained there versus in Israel, that's not necessarily a horrible thing. It's not a good thing, certainly, but it just gives you an idea that the texts were maintained over 1,000 miles apart for a very long period of time. When Maimonides created and codified Rabbinic Judaism, he associated himself with and embraced the Masoretes, who came up with this idea that scriptural Hebrew did not have any vowels. Now, to come up with that view, they had to say that two letters were essentially silent, and they had to misrepresent three additional letters, which is what they went about doing. It becomes apparent and extraordinarily easy to identify just going over the full lexicon of Hebrew words and looking at the letters and looking how they're now vocalized, that the Aleph and the Ain are both vowels, as are the He, the Wah, and the Yod.
This is, by the way, Yada, this is insane. We've got the text of the entire scripts all over the place.
Right.
Not just what's in their hands. What supposedly these were rewritten without vowels to hide everything? I mean, this is insane.
Yeah, of course, because Yahweh constantly tells us that he spoke his Torah to his children, and he constantly tells us to recite the Torah to our children and to listen to him. And the only way you can listen to him, the only way you can recite the Torah to your children, is to be able to read it, and reading it and pronouncing it requires vowels. It's not difficult to figure out that they got this, that their position is wrong. But, you know, it's just like their oral law, where they claim that Rabbinic Judaism is based upon the oral law that was given by Hashem to the elders of Israel and passed down and authorized throughout the millennia. They claim that true, even though the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms beg to differ and said that's just not true. So it's not uncommon for religions to promote obvious deceptions that can't even remotely be true, but nonetheless, this is the history of the Masoretes.
Plus, it's never a good idea.
They think that Yahweh is as stupid as Allah. You know, Allah told an illiterate man to read.
Right.
And they're saying that Yahweh told people to read and recite a language that was not readable or recitable.
Correct. But you're being rational. And you're viewing them from Yahweh's perspective.
That is correct. It's also not rational to get spiritual advice from a pedophile like Muhammad, nor is it rational to get spiritual advice from guys that Yahweh says look like they have animal dung smeared all over their faces.
Well, this is all true, but
yeah.
One has never successfully underestimated a religious person by saying that they lack intellectual integrity. So we should not be surprised by this. I'm just sharing the history because I know that
you're not having to defend it. I know.
Well, I know, and I'm sharing the history because William's question and Marcella's question actually deal with this, and so did Mankow's. How do you know that what you're reading is reliable? And so if you don't, with an open mind, examine the history of the text and know how the diacritical markings were conceived and who the Masoretes were and what the Shoah system is and how it was all worked together, then I think we would tend to make the same mistake that the Christian makes when they say that, you know, my Bible is the inerrant word of God. We never want to preclude the discovery that helps us more completely understand. My view is that when you're exposing things that are untrue but that have influenced that which is true, that you actually gain assurance and credibility that you wouldn't otherwise have. So that's why I think it's, since we are entirely focused on not only coming to know, coming to understand, and accepting what Yahweh has told us, very few things are as important as the textual validity of what we have been, or what we're reading, and what we can and cannot trust, and where we ought to be skeptical. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. Of course, yeah.
Okay.
So you go back to the root of things, that's where you find out where it got corrupted. I mean,
right,
it's as
right.
simple as that.
Yeah, and with Yahweh's testimony, I have found that while it takes time, there is really nothing that you can't resolve in terms of the credibility of the text. There's always little glitches, but they're really small. You so long as you're willing to invest the time and look at all of the potential words that are written the same way but potentially vocalized differently with diacritical marks, and so long as you check to see what we have available to in the Dead Sea Scrolls, I think you can resolve every material issue. But it takes time, and you have to know what you're working with.
If you said to me, Larry, look at this Mizmor, and it says, the beginning of knowledge is the fear of Yahweh. Okay?
Right.
I'd say, well, you know, unfortunately, that's a copy edit, and it's really bad, and this is why.
Right.
Because once Yahweh tells us that all fear of him is a man-made notion, then any place else that people are trying to advance fear of him is a lie.
Yeah. Now, that does not mean, by the way, that Yare, which is the word, can't be translated fear. It can. In fact, it's translated accurately fear twice in the Yashaya 17 and 18 passage that we're going to consider here momentarily. So it can be.
For sure.
But it's just that you can't apply fear to Yahweh because he tells us that that is inappropriate, and also because understanding requires one to appreciate consistency. And so when you apply fear to Father in Covenant, you have a disconnect, if you have an option to resolve the disconnect, which it, with Yare is revere and respect, then with a little effort, it becomes extraordinarily easy to understand what God is saying. Now, we've got the
same problem with worship as well. But I'm just saying, you know, you got to use your head. I mean, I don't care what Logos says at some point.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, there are probably that I have come across of meaningful words with a dichotomy of meaning. There are several hundred in Hebrew where the dichotomy of meanings is actually polar opposites. And anah is one of my favorites, where anah can mean to afflict. That's its secondary meaning, to debase, to humble, to hurt oneself. And but its primary meaning is to answer, to respond. And so when in the context of an invitation, one does not afflict as an answer to an invitation. One responds. But that doesn't mean that ana cannot mean afflict. It just means
you have to
think it through to know when do I apply the affliction connotation and when do I apply the answer and respond connotation. And what I have found that almost universally, that and if the subject is getting to know Yahweh and becoming a member of the covenant family, that the vast preponderance of the time, if there is a dichotomy, for example, like yare, fear and revere, or ana, respond or afflict, that both apply. That in the text itself, you have to choose one or the other. But then as you're contemplating what the statement means, you shortchange yourself if you don't realize that everything God is presenting is under the auspices of free will. So that we have a choice. We're either cut into the covenant or cut out of the covenant. And so in the case of ana, if you do not respond and answer the invitation, then your soul will be afflicted, which is to be diminished and humbled. For example, if you choose not to respect and revere Yahweh to the point that you're willing to get to know him, understand what he's offering, and come to trust and rely on him, you will fear him because you'll be judged by him. So I have found that almost universally that both meanings are intended depending on the predilection of the individual, of whether they're cut into or cut out of the covenant. A great example is, I'm speaking of cut, carrot. Karat. Karat means to establish. It means to cut, as in to cut a deal, to establish. And it's used in connection with the covenant. But karat, that's not karat's only meaning. It also means to cut off, to eliminate, to uproot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and so in the cutting of the covenant, if you're cut into the covenant, then you're established with Yahweh. But if you're cut out of the covenant because you choose religion or politics or just ignorance or rebellion, no matter what, whatever the reason, then you are going to die. And that's you're going to be uprooted and die, and you're going to cease to exist, which are also meanings of karat, to be cut out. So it's important to recognize that I don't think it's possible to effectively translate and understand Yahweh's word, to know what he said and understand what he said, unless you're willing to consistently go through this process of making certain that what is being said fits the context of that particular discussion, like invitation and answer versus invitation and afflict, and that when you have the opportunity to have a statement be consistent with everything that you've come to know and understand about Yahweh, that given the choice, you choose that which is consistent versus inconsistent.
Yet the religious writers will always take the low road. I've noticed that.
Almost always. Not always, but almost always.
Well, right. Enough to totally change Yahweh's character, and that's enough.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Let me give you just a subtle one here. Mikra, or in the singular Mikra. There is no question that it is based on Kara. If you read it in an English Bible, you will read it as convocation, because that's how the rabbis came to present it, a convocation. Now, convocation sounds like a religious ceremony.
Sounds like it to me.
Grand spectacle of pomp and ceremony with a convocation. It's kind of a religious or political term.
Right.
And so is there a derivative somehow, an extrapolation of Kara that could get you to that concept? Yeah, perhaps. But man, do you have to stretch it when the common, most direct meaning of the word is to call out, which is what Yahweh is doing. His invitation, he's calling out to us, And it's not just a ordinary call out. He's trying to call us out of the world.
And then we either honor or we don't.
Right. And it's kara is an invitation or a summons. It's an invitation to those who want to attend the parties. It's a summons to those who don't. It is means to read and recite, which is the only place you're going to find the invitation. And it means to meet and to be welcomed. And so from all of those meanings, could you get convocation? I suppose, but man, that is really tortured. And so, you know, sometimes it's not a deliberate corruption like ecclesia being a translation of mikra, and then rather than being translated, called out is corrupted to church, which is purely demonic and satanic and revoltingly purposeful and deliberate. So sometimes I don't think
and so
deliberate.
Is holy. And so is holy.
Yeah.
That's deliberate.
Yeah, so is holy. Yeah, so is holy.
Hey guys, how you doing?
Hello, William. William, please stay with us because I want to deal a couple of more things with the question that Marcella asked on the mass reach, because a lot of this does deal with one of the questions that you asked, which was that your friend asked. Well, how do you know that what you're reading is reliable? And if you really understand the facts and the history of it, then you can say, well, this is what's reliable, this is what's not, this is how you get to something that is reliable, and then we can go on to say, how does God prove that it's reliable in a moment? All right, so on Masoret, God himself defines the term. He says, and I will extend myself and lead you by way of a specific path under the auspices of the family, and I will arrive and bring into agreement, into compliance, you into compliance with the family-oriented covenant relationship. So God has explained that Masoret, from his point of view, before it's twisted, and if you Google Masoret, you will find a lot of people will say that it means to vocalize. But that's not what it means. The term Masoret, according to Yahweh, means to bring into compliance or to bring into agreement. Now, the reason that's important here is because there are terms and conditions of the covenant. So for us to be in accord with the covenant, for us to be in compliance with the covenant, we need to know what those terms and conditions are, to understand what they are, and to respond to Yahweh and accept them. Pretty straightforward stuff. But it's doing that that puts us in compliance with the covenant, not because our decision makes us perfect, but because God has extended himself. He has arrived to bring us into compliance. So he has a method when we embrace the terms and conditions of the covenant to bring us in compliance with it. And what he does is the third statement, the third codicil, if you will, of the covenant is walk to me and become perfect. Well, God enabled that mechanism of Pesach, Matzah, Mukodam, and Shabuah, Teruah and Kippurim, to bring us into compliance so we could live with him in his sukkah home. So that's what he's saying here. He's saying that, if you figured it out that there are terms and conditions of the covenant, and if you figured out that the mikra enable the terms and conditions of the covenant and bring you into compliance with it, then you figured it out. Then you're right. And if you also figured out that God himself, Yahweh, came down to earth, arrived specifically to lead us on this path, and that it was on behalf of his family, and that it is those seven steps that bring us into compliance with the covenant, then he's saying, you're right, you figured it out. What this statement does is it affirms what we've been saying. And there's not a whole lot of things that are more profound or differentiating about what we have become. And by what we have become, I would refer to us as mostly adopted, but I'm sure there are some natural-born members of the covenant. And what we have become is based upon us recognizing that there are terms and conditions of the covenant. We've come to know Yahweh, understand what they are, and accept them. And God said, if you do that, then based upon what he has done, we're now in Masoret. We're now in compliance with the covenant. And once you are in compliance with the covenant, you are his kid. Enormous freedom, enormous upside. At that point, the entire universe is yours. And yes, Larry, if you want to be called Mr. Hendrick, you can. You got it. I think that was the first thing you wrote today. You
Mr.
Called,
Sir will do.
You
what do you think
called,
of that?
You could even be called King.
All right. Well, okay. Okay. I'm there.
King Larry. And then
I just want to be
you will
King
be royalty.
Yawa.
Yeah, you could be called King King Larry. We're all going to be kings. You know, that's just all there is to it.
Royal family.
Royal family.
That's what I'm talking about here.
Yeah. You know, okay. I can tell you from my point of view, knowing that I have a tendency to err more than I should, that as much responsibility and authority that I can possibly shirk and just enjoy the ride and the camaraderie and the discovery, and linger around that campfire and listen to the sound of the wind go through the tall trees and enjoying a good wine and a good song. I'm going to opt for not having much responsibility personally.
I'm hearing that. But what if it turns out that we turn into lizard people?
Well, I'm not going there. Okay. And I will completely yeah. And I will completely purge wanting to eliminate from you those who rebel audaciously and also those who are openly defiant against me from the land. Those fear-mongering usurpers I will take out unto the soil of Yisrael. They will not return or be included. And you will know that for certain because I am Yahweh. So here he's emphasizing that as it relates to being in compliance with the covenant, if you're in compliance, welcome. Yisrael is your home. It's Yahweh's home. You are welcome. If you're not in compliance with the covenant, you ain't going to stay there. God's going to expel those who are not in compliance with the covenant. So all pretty straightforward stuff. Now, as it relates to the Shoah system, it is a corruption of the Hebrew word that is found in the midst of the third instruction that Yahweh etched in stone, that third statement. And the third statement, Shoah, is used twice. It means to ravage, to destroy, to devastate, to desolate, to cause to be lifeless. It speaks of a lifeless wasteland. It speaks of corruption and of perverting that which is true. And when you recognize Shoah also means that which has failed, that which is not, that which is false, that which is worthless, that which is speaks of speech which is dishonest, that which is empty and leads to nothingness, Shoah is not a good word. You want to be as far from Shoah as you could possibly be as it relates to Yahweh. That's why he says, you know, if you're doing stuff that is corrupting and perverting and lifeless in my name, I am not going to forgive you. There is no forgiveness for such people.
Can I ask you something, Yada?
Yeah. Well,
that is insane. That is like Paul quoting Chabahook.
Mm-hmm.
What in the hell were they doing?
Yeah, I know.
I mean,
because
really.
What Larry has recognized is that the system that the Masoretes embraced for the purpose of vocalizing words is they came to recognize that there were three letters, the three non-silent, the three letters they could not say were silent. You know, they could say that the Aleph and the Ain were silent, but there were three letters they could not claim were silent, that they knew were vowels. But they needed to have some way to corrupt and pervert the pronunciation of those vowels to eliminate the name of Yahweh from their people's vocabulary. And so they named the system for doing that, Shoah. And then because of the nature of that system, which perverts the pronunciation of the yod, the he, and the wa, is there something about a yod, a he, and a wa that strikes you about Yahweh's name? Is there a connection between yod, he, and wa in Yahweh's name?
Yeah, it's the whole thing.
Like every letter, right? Okay,
yeah,
so
that's it.
Every letter. So the purpose of the Shoah system was to change the pronunciation of those three letters because they were the three letters that they knew were vowels, but they couldn't silence like they could with the Aleph and the Ain. So the Shoah system, which they changed to Shaba because they wanted to they changed the W from the O sound as a vowel to a V. So they call it a Shaba system. It means to ravage, to destroy, to devastate, to desolate. And that was their system. This word that means to pervert and to corrupt was their system to vocalize the letters in the Hebrew alphabet.
That is a little in your face, you know, in my opinion.
Well, you know, it's not much different than Hillel ben Shakar saying that that which is pure, good, and appropriate for you to consume is halal in the Quran, right?
That's true. That is so very true.
How could you be more in your face?
I think it's halal, Ben Shakar, by the way.
Yeah.
I don't think it's halal.
Yeah, so whether it's halal or halal.
He's trying to be a shining object.
Right.
I mean, that is halal. You know,
yeah,
so I'm sure
right.
That's halal. I don't
you
think
know,
it's halal.
Do you think it's a little in your face when both Muhammad and Paul both claim to be demon-possessed?
Yeah, that's pretty in your face as well.
Yeah.
Don't get me wrong, but to name it and knowing they're naming it that way, and I mean, that's just so over the top. I mean, it floored me when you told me that was the name of the system. I just
fell out
of my chair over here laughing.
Yep. So, Marcelo, that's the whole and complete answer to who the Masoretes are, what Masoret actually means, how Yahweh uses the term, which is to bring us in compliance with the conditions of his family relationship, and how he personally himself engages to do so. So that we can be part of his family and live in his home, and how religious individuals have worked to corrupt that message. And that brings us to Sir William. You wrote me and said you had an encounter with a fellow that was intellectually bright, but in terms of being able to transition from knowing to understanding, he was a few cards shy of a full deck.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, he's very, very bright, but every one of his response was a question, and the question was always, well, how do you know? How do you know if that's accurate? How do you know? So the deeper we went into the discussion, he just, you know, he said, well, how do you know the Qumran scrolls is accurate?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. And
how can you
confirm
that?
If we did not have the Qumran scrolls, we'd be fine. We'd be fine.
Right.
We really would be. If we did not have the Qumran scrolls, the differences between the Masoretic and the Qumran scrolls are, on average, one word in 14 or 15. So, are we better served to have them? Absolutely. But if we didn't have them, we'd still be okay. Because the primary issue, really, with the Qumran scrolls is not just that one word in 15 has been changed. And some of that, you know, is small in the sense of a singular, plural, or a stem, or a mood, or a spelling difference, or that sort of thing.
They do try to hide Yahusha. I mean, they do try to hide.
Well, yeah, but in the Masoretic text, Yahweh's name still appears. It's just that in the Masoretic text, Adonai, my Lord, is written above it, not over it, over it in the sense of above it. Of replacing it. It's written over it so that they will say, my Lord, as opposed to Yahweh's name. But,
yeah, I understand that.
Right. The Masoretic text, isn't horrible. It really isn't. And so long as you're willing to invest the time to look up what the words mean and not stop with the first lexicon, to go lexicon upon lexicon and constantly think through the process with the Masoretic text, you can come to understand everything that we've come to know. You would not
well,
be limited
the, yeah,
anyway.
But, I mean, they do things like in Psalm 22,
right.
You know, change. They pierce to, like lions, they're at my feet, or
right.
Lions,
yeah, that is,
they
that's
fall
correct.
At my feet.
Yeah, they did. And,
you know,
and, you know, if we didn't know that Yahweh said they will look upon me whom they have pierced, as opposed to him saying, like lions, they tear at my feet, one is much better than the other, and one happens to be accurate. You know, the fact is that even in the Septuagint has it right. But beyond mm-hmm. that, we know what happened on Pesach with Yahusha, because we're told what happened in Psalm 22 and Psalm 88 and Yahusha. So we're told in all those places. So, well, I agree that is a horrible change that was made deliberately to mislead Jews by rabbis. It wouldn't. The fact that it has been corrected is a help, but it would not profoundly cripple our understanding of who Yahweh is and what He's offering without it. Now, that being said. So the answer is, if somebody asks you, what if you didn't have, how do you know the Dead Sea Scrolls are true? This is how you know that the overall text is reliable. Whether your source is the Dead Sea Scrolls or whether your text is the Masoretic. Okay, so because they don't differ by a lot. Okay, it's fair to say, now you cannot say that related to the so-called Christian New Testament. There it is that's a disaster. Okay, that is a disaster. But as it relates to the Masoretic text and the Dead Sea Scrolls, the fidelity between the two of them, considering the gap of time from which they were created, is so great. In some cases, 1,400 years. The fidelity between the two is stunningly good. All right? For as flawed as we are as humans, we have to recognize it is stunningly good. Okay, that being the case, how do you know that the text that we are considering, whether it be the Masoretic or the Dead Sea Scrolls, or the unification of them, is reliable? How do we know?
Prophecy.
That is certainly one way. Do you have James, do you have any other?
You have the scientific and historical accuracies, but you know, for me,
the scientific accuracy.
Of the words.
Yeah, let's just go one at a time. Prophecy, of course, is the big one, and hopefully we'll get some time to do Yahusha 17 and 18, because that prophecy is goosebump time. It is.
I really want to hear that.
Absolutely goosebump time, but. There are so many prophecies, and of course, all of the prophecies regarding Yahusha with the Dead Sea Scrolls are committed to paper, where we know what was said long before they occurred. Now, so prophecy is one. Scientific accuracy. That's the reason why I think that for atheists and agnostics, the best place for them to go is the opening volume of Yada Yah, because it shows the extent to which Yahweh's creation account is not only perfectly accurate and in perfect accord with known science, it preceded known science by 3,400 years.
Yeah,
subjects like the Big Bang, like subjects like relativity. Right.
Or in Che chapter. It's interesting. I've laid that out to a couple of agnostics, and he said, well, you're never going to convince me. I said, I don't really care if I convince you.
I don't care. Can I prove it? And yes, you can. The scientific accuracy of the Genesis account proves emphatically that the Creator himself inspired the words. absolutely.
I told him I'm convinced you're a horse's ass, is what I told him.
Well, okay. Well, that may be true. But nonetheless, James's statement that the science, not only of that, but the science of the flood and what and the upwelling of seawater and what we found in terms of the asteroid strike, you know, the scientific accuracy. You know, I was watching a program earlier this week. Apophis is back in the news. And the reason Apophis is back in the news is that scientists have finally come to realize that all of their calculations as to whether it's going to miss us or hit us are really
guesstimates,
and they don't know. And
of course
so
they don't know.
There's a whole scientific community right now that is coming up with means to put a tracking device on Apophis, MN2004, because of the fact that they're scared spitless that in, on April 13th of 2029, that sucker is not only going to hit, but it is so massive that it's going to devastate this planet. And so it's not going to exterminate life on the entire planet, but it will be by far the largest calamity ever experienced by man. So they're trying to track it. And then, but they're also realizing that the tracking itself is not sufficient because they can't at this point come up with any idea, any proof that it's not going to hit. So what they're saying is there are five or six schemes that we can deploy that will nudge it out of the way.
Yeah, which, now, by the way, I read about that about 6 months ago, that Obama was putting money into that. Or
right.
The Obama administration.
You know, the Discovery Channel presented that. I mean, the scientists, these are not, you know, aliens among us. These are legitimate scientists, and they're saying the fact is we don't know if it's going to hit us or miss us. Those are the facts. We need to put tracking devices on it, and we need to begin now to develop and deploy a mechanism for directing Apophis from us because of the consequences if it hits us. And so when you recognize that Yahweh had presented the timing of an asteroid named Apophis that was going to strike the Earth and create this cataclysmic consequence nearly 2,000 years ago, that he named the asteroid and told us when it was going to hit, and that's the day that it's approaching the Earth. You know, you look at that and you say, all right, you want to be an agnostic? You want to claim that it's not proven? Have at it.
It's not just that. It's the timing. It's also when Zachariah describes these fast-flying war machines
with
drivers in them.
Right.
That this could only happen in the last 100 years. And he's laying it out for this exact time period. It's
right.
The way it all falls in.
Right.
It's the 100% accuracy of it all.
Right.
It's
so the next thing that James mentioned is history. What's amazing about the Torah and the prophets and the Psalms is that every turn of the archaeologist's spade has affirmed that it is precisely accurate. You know, if you look at the entire host of other books of antiquity, they're not even, I mean, they will have typically 10% accuracy, like the Iliad and the Odyssey. There's a grain of reality there, but then layered upon that is just great myth and storytelling. Right. Myth and storytelling. But with the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, when it says that, you know, Abraham went to this town and there was a great arch as the gateway, and on the gateway there were, you know, a carved eagle, and that the town was located in this position at this particular time, you know, and we dig there, we find the gates. You know, if it says that Abraham went to Mitzrayim and had a meeting, and this was the result, we find in the hieroglyphics in Egypt historical evidence that he was there at that time. And, I mean, you, no matter what you name, it is like when the Assyrians came. In Assyria, there is a whole group of steels that say, yeah, I went there, and I had them surrounded. But dagnabbit, they got away. You know, it's all there. And when the Assyrians, rather than the Babylonians, when the Assyrians attacked the Northern Kingdom, it details how many slaves they took with them. It's all there. It's all precisely affirmed. So the history of it proves it. Now, I'm going to say that there are two other aspects that if you're talking to a person who genuinely wants to know and who is open and receptive to evidence and reason. Now, William, this is not going to fly with a person whose mind's already made up. But there are two other aspects. One is that one of the ways that we come to know that Paul was a false prophet and a false apostle is he's constantly contradicting himself and the God he claims to speak for. You can't find a contradiction in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. You can't find a single inconsistent statement. Written over thousands of years, you can't find a single inconsistent statement. And so,
thousands of years by different authors, which goes without saying.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Actually, the same author, but a different pen. Yeah, I know what you mean.
Okay.
Yeah, we all know what you mean. The next aspect of it, James, happens to be your and my personal favorite. What is the other way that if somebody says, well, how do you know this is trustworthy? Okay, you've got prophecy, you've got history, you've got science, you've got a complete lack of contradictions. What else do you have?
The majesty of the words.
Yeah, the brilliance.
Now, who else can make take a metaphor and actually, you know, as the saying goes, make it walk on all four?
Yeah, that's part of it. I'd say the part of it that is the... and I've gone from that, which is just the brilliance of the whole story, to now the intimacy of the story. You know, today we talked about Yahweh making himself vulnerable. The presentation of God is so different than any human has ever perceived God, and so perfect for what you would want God to be like, where God says, I'm going to grow with you, telling you that you know, I'm vulnerable here because my happiness, my growth, my eternity is based upon what I give to you. I mean, that kind of a perspective on God is so unexpected, so radically different from anything that man would ever conceive, and yet so perfect and so consistent with the whole concept of the covenant that I'm willing to say, all right, I'm going to, if I had an argument, that's way, way too profound, way too enlightening and important to ignore. So, William, those are the ways that you know what we are reading is true. The same question that Mankow asked me on his interview. How do you know that you're right? And the answer is because Yahweh proved that he was God and that he authored the Torah, prophets, and Psalms. So all we have to do is to know that since the Creator God of the universe proved that he authored them and proved that he is who he is, then you know you're right if you properly convey what he said.
How do you get to Moed Mikra? I mean, think about this. You know, you're walking out of Egypt, right? Day one, as you put it, you know, day two, you're into matzah. Day three, you're crossing there. You're born and become a child.
Born into his family, right? You got dad leading the way.
And, you know, seven sevens later, you're up there on Mount Sinai. Then we got to the same thing with the fulfillment of the Moed. The exact, you know, I mean, just doing the odds on this stuff gets amazing, right? I mean,
of course, yeah. And in year 2000, he delineates every aspect of the covenant, and then has Abraham provide a dress rehearsal of the doorway into his home on Mount Moriah in year 2000, and then in year 4000, he himself takes a diminished manifestation of himself, and he enables and fulfills his promise related to the first four mikre in year 4000 to deliver all of the promises, or deliver on the promises he had made relative to the benefits of the covenant. And that, you know, we're looking at this, at the world, and he's giving us the timeline for him to return, and it's, son of a gun, it's year 2033, 6,000, yeah, and it fits within all of the timeline and prophecies he's given us. You're going to say, ah, I just got lucky, I guess.
Well, that was my response to
Damascus being a heap of ruin, right? Damascus, a heap of ruin. All this centered around, what did you say it was? Less than 0.1% of the world's
mass?
Real planet
mass, yeah.
Who the hell would care about it?
So, William, you shared all of that with him. And his response to that was just to quiz you some more because he couldn't process it?
Oh, yeah, he felt that I should have been well-versed in scientific issues and mathematics and philosophy.
So what is the connection, just other than a red herring?
For someone
to say, God's pretty specific here. He says, you know, he never tells us, I want you to know everything in the world. What he tells you is that I want you to focus on who I am and what I'm offering you. I want you to be very observant in terms of what I have shared with you. And I want you to listen to what I have said so that you come to know who I am and what I'm offering so you can respond. Does he ever say that I want you to become an expert mathematician?
No.
No. Does he ever say I want you to become a scientist?
No.
No. Is one of the benefits of the covenant a complete understanding of human philosophy?
No.
No. I mean, so to say that because you understand, you've come to know Yahweh and understand what he's offering through his covenant means that you are supposed to be an expert in human philosophy and mathematics is like saying my first tricycle was red, I ought to love the color blue.
I basically told him, look, the evidence is there for us to reason with if you choose to confirm it via research.
Right.
And that's really a personal decision, isn't it? I mean, we have to decide to do that. We have to decide that our time is well worth investing.
William, was this guy a Christian or was he an agnostic?
No, it's funny because he's not an atheist. He understands what it is to be an agnostic, and then but yet he feels that an individual who's an agnostic, I mean, for excuse the French, that he says they're a dumbass. But then he says, I guess I'm an agnostic because I know there's something there.
Yeah.
Well, I would say to him.
Before we even address that, let me give you a little more background because William gave me some more background on who the fellow is. The fellow is like a lot of people that I've had to correspond with over the years, and his story is such that you're probably never going to be able to reason with him, William.
Right.
But he is where he is because he had a young son that died in the first few days of life. Mm-hmm. And he's trying to say...
First 7 minutes.
First 7 minutes of life, his son died. And so his first response is the first response that most people have in that situation.
God did it to him.
That's right, that God, they're mad at God.
Right.
And that, therefore, if there's a God, God doesn't give a crap. Or if there's a God, God is mean. Or I hate God. It's God is to blame for the death of his son. And how there can't be a loving God, because if there was a loving God, that these bad things would never happen to children.
Right.
Now, of course, what that means is that God would have to intervene in everything. They don't think it through.
That would eliminate free choice, totally.
Of course.
That'd be the
that would mean that everything in this world is just a stage where we are puppets, because God would have to have his strings on everything. He would have to control every single thing that happened in the universe to keep young people from ever suffering. But by the way, if we never suffered, we would have no character.
Mm-hmm.
If we never suffered, then we would never be in a position where we could grow or overcome or have that, you know, yesterday I had an episode of what I would consider to be suffering. It's the last verse of the 18th chapter of Isaiah. It made no sense to me. I could not figure out how it was even possible that this statement could be translated in a way that made any sense, because it talks about a people being brought out of America as a gift to Yahweh. And I'm saying, no, it's just, and they're being brought to Mount Zion. And I'm saying, there is no way. There is no way. I could spend a month on this. There is no way to make sense of that. And so yesterday, and, you know, you don't have a lot of free time these days, so I didn't suffer very long on this, but I want to get back into it, but I don't know how to translate this. What I ended up, by the time I was through, I said, oh, my goodness, this is exactly what it has to be. This is unbelievably profound, what God just told us. But I really had to struggle with it, and I want to tell you that the process of struggling and with it to finally come out with something that was, wow, blow me away, God. I mean, that
what does it say?
That is so cool. Well, why would I give away the end of the thing? We haven't even gone to the beginning of it. But the point I wanted to make is...
Let me sucking bullets that, over here. Come on.
Okay, but the point I want to make is that if we didn't have to overcome challenges along the way when growing up, we'd have no backbone, we'd have no muscle, we'd have no desire, we'd have no will, we'd have no character.
Can I tell you a true story here? This is a true
sure.
story. I left home at 15.
Right.
Okay, this was after my dad had me thrown in jail for something.
Yeah, I know, but you were a bad boy. You didn't deserve getting thrown in jail, but you were a bad boy.
Whatever, you know. And you know, here I am now, you know, former president of the PTA. Okay,
yeah.
So
you stole a six-pack of beer, right? Wasn't that your thing? You stole the case.
It was 10 cases of beer, but you know, whatever.
All right.
The point being is that I was on my own after that for many, many, many years.
Yeah.
And I had many, many friends that their parents were wealthy and took care of whatever problems they had.
Right.
And I'll tell you, they didn't develop character. And true character is developed in the fires of adversities.
Yeah.
And that is true.
Let me share one with you, too, Larry. My father was very mean to me. In fact, so mean that he threatened to kill me. To survive my father and to overcome being shy, feeling totally incapable and inadequate, feeling like a total and complete loser, to overcome that and to be willing to like start a business and employ people and to take risks, to speak on a show like this, to overcome what was really a horrible experience is the very thing that built the kind of character and confidence that enables what we're doing today. I would never have been in this position had it not been for developing really thick skin, coming to finally realize, in fact, with my father...
Well, it sounds like you grew up in Nazi Germany, too.
Yeah, and you know, what I had to realize with my father is that if I care about what he thinks about me, and if I try to please him so that he thinks more favorably of me, I will be destroyed. And so now... when I get all the hate letters from people, I don't even read them. I'll get two sentences into it, and I'll just delete. I don't care. It's irrelevant.
Oh, I've been sent to hell 1,000 times.
Right. So
I mean,
it prepares
10 times that.
Right.
You know,
right. So it prepares you for that kind of thing. So, I mean, is that going to work with somebody that lost a son in 7 minutes? No. But that's the reason why there has to be some struggle, some...
But Yahweh tells us flat out, and because your forefathers, you know, either disregarded, forgot the Torah, whatever, I forgot you and your children. Says it right there.
I know. But, you know, so this guy who has lost his son in 7 minutes came to the conclusion that God doesn't get a crap about anybody, and that God, therefore, is like Mother Nature, and Mother Nature with the storms just plows through everybody and kills everybody in the wake, and that is just like God. He's an absentee landlord. He doesn't give a crap about anybody, and therefore, you can equate God with Mother Earth, which is what basically the Babylonians did and every pagan religion has done since.
Well, God doesn't care about everybody.
Right,
that's
true.
I know.
That's true. He doesn't.
That's true.
He's not an absentee landlord. It's amazing how many smart people write me letters, William, and have that exact same reasoning, that because young people suffer, there can't be a God. If there is a God, he's incapable or he's uninterested. And,
then there's no free will. Then there's no free will. And so the very reason that Adam and Chawa were allowed to be tricked by Ha-Satan, so that they wouldn't be kept birds in a cage with no free will, they'd have to choose to be with Yahweh. That didn't happen either.
Do humans get a huge percentage of children right now are born functionally dead because their parents consumed drugs? Did God conceive those drugs? Of course not. A huge percentage of children are stricken with cancers. In fact, cancer is increasing at a 50% rate worldwide because of what we have done to pollute ourselves. We're obese, and we eat all sorts of things that are unhealthy for us. Did God tell us to become obese and to eat things that will that are harmful to us? Of course not.
No.
You know, a huge part of children dying and having accidents is because mankind has thought that it makes great sense to war with his fellow man. Did God start those wars? Of course not.
No.
When a child kills themselves or is killed by a suicide bomber, how do you blame God? You know?
I don't.
Somebody decides that they're going to drink and drive and plows into a family and kills that family and it has a two-year-old and a car seat in the back. Why would you blame God?
Yeah, and I kind of went that direction with him, Yada, and he actually got angry because when he started to say stuff like that, what I said to him was, I said, can I ask you a question? He's like, sure. I'm like, guns, for example, right? I said,
right.
Who's doing the killing? Is it the gun or the person pulling the trigger? Yeah, and he's like, oh, and he's just kind of got into a fit of rage about it because it's the person pulling the trigger is doing the killing,
not the actual gun.
The gun's being used.
But you see, he's built his entire life about being angry at God for the seven-minute life of his son.
And I sympathize with him. Don't get me wrong. I mean, that's a hard thing to
go through. I do, too.
Yeah, that's a hard thing to go through.
Yeah, I do, too.
I got a little harder bark on me than that. Somebody you knew 7 minutes, I can see them going through a little grieving, but to be hateful for life, be one thing if it was a 5-year-old, okay? I mean, I think he's a crybaby.
Okay, I
want to
tell you that, Larry, I can both agree with you and I can also sympathize with him. I can tell you, though, that you're right, that for example, if one of my sons were to die before me, I would be devastated. And I would be absolutely
devastated. None of us want that to happen.
You know,
would I
figure out a way to go on and to try to make a contribution? Absolutely. But I'd be devastated. I can tell you that. And,
7 minutes?
The last point I wanted to make on this whole thing, William, is that the primary reason that religion sells is because it answers the question that people have, their concerns over death. This person created his own religion over the death of his son. And so the primary impetus for religion is death. Mm-hmm. I was listening to the Olympics last night, and there's a girl who did the half pike in snowboarding, a Canadian girl, and she was a daredevil. And in addition to being doing the aerials and she hit her head, and after hitting her head, she died a few days later at about 20 years old, and the parents are obviously grieving for her, but the parents have gone on, but The fact of the matter is everybody that knew her is all saying she's up in heaven now looking down with us at so happy that,
right.
that she
and
got
if
her
we said what we said, we would become we would get stoned
for
telling them the truth.
That is correct. If we were to tell them the truth, we'd be stoned because it is the universal acceptance of people near universal is that every dead loved one is up in heaven looking down at them, and we will be back together with them in heaven. And that is what makes religion popular. Of course, it's not true, but that's what makes religion popular. This guy created a religion, his hatred for God because of what happened to his son. That is the source of almost all religious myth, is trying to answer death.
Can I ask you a question? It's kind of jumping off the topic a little bit, but I have my nephews. I think they may be listening tonight.
Okay.
And Elvis and Ethan, the little one, Evan, he's still a baby, but they actually, you know, we're talking about death, and they had a little cat, and the cat,
uh-huh.
you know, died recently, and,
uh-huh.
and they were a mess, you know, they're kids, they're little kids,
right.
they've never witnessed death before, and
uh-huh.
and so they wanted to know if the cat goes to heaven.
Uh-huh.
If animals go to heaven, and I would imagine there will be animals in heaven.
Yeah, I am certain that there are animals in heaven, because Eden, the experience that Yah relates to us in Eden, he doesn't tell us a lot about what he and Adam did, but what little mm-hmm. he tells us about what he did tells us that since Eden is a symbol for life, eternity of eternity in Yahweh's home. That is what it's the Garden of Great Joy. Eden is specifically designed to tell us what heaven is going to be like. There are really three things that we learn that existed in Eden. One is that we get to listen to God. He talks directly to us. Number two, we walk with Him. He walks with us, we get to walk with Him, which means we get to explore together. But there's one specific event that we're told about. And that event is that Yahweh takes all of the life forms that He has created, animal life forms, and He parades all of these animal life forms in front of He and Adam, and they talk about them, and they name them, and the duck waddles by, and the platypus, and the giraffe, and Adam are examining animal life and having a grand old time talking about it, which means that when we go into eternity with Him, there's going to be lots and lots and lots of animal life. Now,
you know something
or not,
else, I think?
You know
something
or not, by
else,
the way,
I
the,
think?
The, okay, let me just one thought. Whether or not the consciousness, the nephesh, of our favorite pet goes along and ends up with us, I can't say for sure, but there is nothing that would preclude it. I suspect that it is likely, and with the call that we had today from Diane, where they were talking about Caleb. That Caleb, and it's with a K, we've transliterated for some reason with a C, but it's with a K, he had the right spirit, and which was Yahweh's spirit, and that he was
Hebron.
Steadfastly devoted to his relationship with Yahweh. So, I mean, he was coming on in, and he was getting his inheritance in the promised land, as opposed to those who had a different spirit. So it wasn't that Caleb's spirit was different than Yahweh's, it was that Caleb's spirit was different than many of the Israelites, because the Israelites did not have Yahweh's spirit. But Caleb's name means dog. You know, and
really?
can you think in this world, I know a lot of people are cat people. I'm not a cat person, I'm a dog person. So this metaphor means more to me than probably it does to cat people. But can you imagine a living soul that is more loyal, that is more unconditionally loving, that is a better companion than a dog?
No, you can't.
No.
Dogs and save people's lives.
The fact that Caleb was means dog, and he has the, you know, and he was kind of come on in and be part of God's home and was welcomed with open arms. It's just one of many hymns that tells me, yeah, we're going to see animals in heaven and be able to communicate with them, have an enjoyable, beneficial relationship with them. Life is going to be abundant.
You know, one thing I'm sure of, just because I know Yahweh's nature.
Yes.
Whatever it is that happens to animals, I don't care if it's a bird in the sky, okay? When that animal dies, there's nothing bad that happens. Something good must happen. I'm sure of it.
Well, I can't tell you that something good always happens. I can tell you something bad never happens. My sense is that something good's going to happen. I'm with you. I think it's likely.
You know, I don't think. I mean, the gazelle was made to be chased down by the the lions.
Right. But we're going to come to a time where the lion is no longer happy to chase the gazelle. We are, and that's what Yahweh says about the lion and the lamb, and during the millennial celebration of Shabbat, is that which by the way, if during the millennial celebration of Sukkah and of the Shabbat, if the lion is laying down next to the lamb, what can you tell for certain about that 1,000-year celebration of foretaste of eternity with Yahweh?
Well, I think either meat grows on trees or something.
No. But one thing you can tell for certain is that there are lions and lambs, right?
Oh, yeah. Well,
there are
animals. For sure.
There are animals.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a good
thing.
I think that's a really good thing. All right.
Awesome.
Now we've answered the question. Unless you have another one, William, we'll go to Yashiga 17.
Awesome.
Okay. I'm going to go through this because we don't have a whole lot of time, kind of quickly so we can get to the summary of events. This is a prophetic pronouncement regarding Damascus. Behold, Damascus is revolting and corrupt and will be removed from among inhabited cities. It is degenerate and unrestrained and shall be abolished. And it shall actually become a twisted and tangled heap of rubble. Boy, that is really descriptive. Where every word of that is consistent with what we're witnessing. Abandoned and forsaken, estranged, deserted, and destroyed, will be in the inhabited regions and populated cities of Aroer, speaking of the outcasts in Jordan and Lebanon. For there will be roaming animals and militant militias failing miserably, but then ultimately there will be no one left to terrorize. So we're going to see not only Damascus destroyed, but the outcasts in Jordan and Lebanon, and those in the in inhabited cities surrounding Syria, gonzo, as well as the huge mythical population of Palestinians in those places. And the terrorists are going to continue to roam as terrorists, murdering, but ultimately, you know, for there to be a terrorist, there have to be civilians, and ultimately there's not going to be any civilians left for them to terrorize. So the fortified place and defensive structures will cease to exist on account of the northern kingdom, which is Ephraim, along with the government out of Damascus. So the government out of Damascus is going to cease to exist. That's how I came to realize, all right, that was one of the answers I was looking for.
So will Assad's Sunnis, going down.
Will the Sunnis prevail or will Assad prevail? This is a God, according to Yahweh, Assad does not succeed. The government of Assyria is going to fail. So the government out of Damascus, including the remnant of Syria. Now, Syria is Aram, which is Greater Syria. So it's Syria more than just in the geographic sense of just that one country. But so the government out of Damascus falls, as does the nation of Syria, for being similarly vehement and burdensome, fanatical and onerous, dim-witted and enraged. The children of Yisrael, those individuals who engage and endure with God, shall actually continue to exist, prophetically declares Yahweh, of the vast array of spiritual messengers and envoys. Now, he's going to say a lot of bad things are going to happen, but Yisrael will continue. And it will actually come to pass in that day that the size of Jacob will be decreased to the point of no longer being sustainable. And the fattest, best protected, and most vital midsection of his body shall be leaned, shrinking in size.
And that would be the West Bank.
That is correct, because Gaza is already gone. So God has said, starts in Damascus, because of all the things he just said about Damascus. It spreads out to Jordan and Lebanon. The government out of Damascus falls. Syria ceases to be an independent nation. It's destroyed. And while Israel is still going to survive all of this, it's going to be thinned at the waist to the point that it is no longer sustainable as a direct result of what happens here. And then it shall be like the gleaning in and receiving of a harvest, of reaping the grain from the chaff in season, cutting it away so as to remove it from a vexing time of grief, thereby by establishing and validating the standing grain. So God is saying that when Israel is thin at the waist, following the destruction of Damascus and Israel and Syria no longer being a viable country and Israel no longer being sustainable, but it's still going to exist even though it's now vulnerable, that God's going to gather in a secondary harvest, a gleaning, that he's going to intervene in a secondary harvest to keep his children out of a vexing time of grief. And that those he is harvesting are the standing grain. Grain is always the matter.
Does it mention the sacrificial lamb being the one?
Yeah, it does. That's next.
Okay.
That's next. Okay. So the standing grain means those of us who are standing with him, and the grain is saved souls. So those saved souls who are standing up with him, they're going to be harvested to be kept out of that vexing time. Then it goes on to say, and with his sacrificial lamb, his strong arm and ability to shoulder burdens, his visible appearance is light, his aurora, he will be collecting and harvesting the first fruits. So now we know the mechanism for God removing us from the earth during this vexing time. It's through his aurora, his sacrificial lamb. And it shall be as a gleaning, a smaller secondary harvest of ears of grain. In the valley of Rephaim, which is in the midst of souls destined to die. So it is from
which is
this
the
whole
world.
Earth, which is now this pitiful valley of souls destined to die, there is a secondary harvest, because the primary harvest was Bakudam, of the ears of the standing grain in the valley where the souls that are left are destined to die. And in him, speaking of Jacob and thus Israelites and the children of the covenant, there will be those who leave based on the choices they have made, gleanings, smaller secondary harvests, as in going around and encompassing and shaking off as a means of harvesting an olive tree. Two or three ripe olives in the top uppermost branch, four or five on her fruitful branches which have been separated, prophetically declares Yahweh, the mighty one of Israel. What does he mean there? Why would he talk about the two different types of branches? Two or three from one, four or five from the other. I think the answer is...
Because there's two groups. There's Yehudim, right. And there's Israel. I get it.
Yeah, there's those of us who were adopted, who are in a branch that is separated, and there's those mm-hmm. that are in the uppermost branch in the olive tree that represents Israel, direct descendants mm-hmm. of Jacob. And so those that are in the uppermost branch that represents direct descendants of Jacob, it's two or three. Those who are... or on the branch that is separated would be us, Goyim, there's going to be four or five. Whether you take the two lowest, the lowest number and the highest number, or the two middle numbers, it totals seven. I think it's 7,000 people are going to be part of this gleaning.
It's not going to be many.
No.
And I'm not sure which side of the branch I fall on. Like I said,
I know,
the name.
Right.
Was
there's
Hendrix
a lot of us.
Meyer.
Right, yeah, there's a lot of people, a lot of us that really don't know, that that may have Yehudim and Yisraelite ancestry, and you're one of them. You know, and while I have a preference, I would love to be naturally born. I think that would be that'd be cool. I'm not sure it's going to make a difference in the end, particularly.
Well, I'm sure it doesn't. I mean,
yeah.
You know, whatever.
Yeah,
yeah,
but
I'm just saying,
yeah.
It's kind of a weird thing.
I'm happy to have chosen to be adopted. If that's as good as it's going to get for me, I'm fully content.
Yeah, me too.
With that.
Me too.
Yeah.
I mean, I could have been from a religious family or something, and would have known. But
yeah, yeah. There's some
really
advantages, by the
up.
Way, of being adopted, because through adoption, it's pure 100% choice. I've chosen to be adopted. Okay, in that specific day, this man, this descendant of Adam, will genuinely regard and consistently accept the Almighty, his Maker. And his eyes will actually and continually look toward God, the set-apart one of Yisrael, of individuals who engage and endure with God. So what we're told here is that on that day, those among those 7,000, the one thing we're going to have in common is that we all regard and accept the Almighty, and that we are consistently focused on him. So then, those of us who are harvested on this day, so then he shall never regard, accept, consider, nor look upon religious altars. That means that when we are with Yahweh in heaven, there ain't going to be no religion. The works, what fingers have made,
yeah.
They will not focus upon. Whether the Asherah, which is the basis of Christianity, that's also Mother Earth, that's the Queen of Heaven, the Mother of God, that's the basis of Easter, the basis of Christmas, the basis of Sunday worship. Whether the Asherah, the religious myth representing the Mother of God and the Queen of Heaven, who is associated with, by the way, Asherah is the Queen of Heaven and the Mother of God. She is the Lord, Baal's wife. Or the worship of the sun god images and resulting religious monuments. That's from Chaman. So there's not going to be any religion or any religious artifacts to look at, whether they be Asherah or sun god images. In that specific day, it shall come to be that the cities of his, and we're still talking about Jacob's, refuge and defensive fortifications shall be abandoned. Almost like there was an occult presence in the thicket, as if drugged with mind-altering incantations or biological agents. And then in the uppermost branch of the olive, relationally and beneficially, will be completely deserted for a time because of the presence of the children of Yisrael. And so appalling desolation and stupefying ruin, a stunning and astonishing deforestation, horrible devastation, leaving these places ravaged and temporarily uninhabitable, completely deserted and desolate, so that they are a wasteland, will exist for a time as a result of the choices they have made. Now, while I am fairly certain that this is primarily addressing Yisrael, previously when I was looking at this, I saw, you know, Christianity in every word, which was the first thing that I translated for Ken in future history. And so I saw that devastation being in America's cities, but it's not. Is there a chance that the world cities will also be devastated at this time? Yes. But is the primary focus here still Yisrael? Yes. And that's the reason why his children are being removed, because some real bad stuff is coming down. Appalling desolation, stupefying ruin, stunning and astonishing deforestation, horrible devastation. Indeed, because, rather branded by another, you have completely ignored and actually forgotten, becoming totally ignorant of the God of your salvation and deliverance, your Savior, the rock of your protection and refuge. And you do not mention or remember the Most High. So who is he talking to? He's talking to the Israelites. He says, you know, your nation, first you're going to be left, and Israel is going to be devastated because you are associated with another. You have completely ignored and totally forgotten, completely ignorant of the God of your salvation, your Savior, your rock. you do not remember or mention the Most High. That's why you don't want to be among those who are left behind. Therefore, you plant the Lord's vines. And Lord is meant here. It's Satan's vines. You plant the Lord's vines, and you consistently sow an illegitimate, unauthorized, and loathsome means to estrangement by way of a vine branch that needs to be pruned. In that day, you raise your garden, and the early part of the day, your seed will bud and sprout, reaping a shaken and corrupted heap, which is piled up and will be thrust aside. In the daytime, there will be weakness, affliction, and tribulation, including the influence of incurable and incapacitating physical pain and mental anguish. He's talking about the tribulation here. And he's talking about even Israelites siding with the Torahless one. Woe. Be wary. A great many nations roaring like hordes of agitated terrorists, these multitudes of confused and loud-mouthed militants flaunting what they possess, similar to the chaotic uproar and snarling and growling of the seas. Islamic terrorists are going to roll into Israel as a tidal wave, as a flood. And they will wail in agitated and anguished screams, and the roar of societal chaos of the people, of the nations, will be like the horrible uproar of floodwaters, intensely and in great numbers with grating passion. They will continuously strive to desolate and to lay waste, and ultimately will be destroyed. This massive number of people who gather together will be like the horrible chaos and riotous roar of floodwaters. Massively great, widespread, and abundant shall be their desire to destroy everything while they strive to lay waste, giddy in the process as they crash into the land as a massive and roaring storm. God is explaining what the Magog War is going to be like. Who's going to perpetrate it and what it's going to be like. These are not happy words. But he will rebuke them, issuing a strong warning against them while criticizing their corruption. And so they will be forced to flee, taking flight as a result of being driven back, ultimately ceasing to exist on account of being alienated. He's going to throw them out of the land. And they will be chased, pursued, and driven away, similar to the chaff that dies and discarded on the hills before the approaching presence of the Spirit. And like the chariot wheels of troop transports rolling like tumbleweeds before the approaching presence of the storm. Now this is and we're out of time, so we'll have to continue this next time. But what God is saying is that he is going to use his set-apart Spirit to blow them away. But he's also saying that while his Spirit blows away the Muslims who have attacked Israel, enraged as a tidal wave, as a flood, that he is blowing them away prior to the approaching storm. It's America that precipitates the storm. The storm is what comes next. This is just the first wave that crashes into Israel. There's another that's coming. He says specifically that he's doing this prior to the approaching storm. The storm's not good. The storm is even worse than what he has been describing. And he's about to transition from talking about Israel to America. And so That's where we'll leave it,
and we'll start right out there. It's clearly America. I've read the other, but yeah, it's America.
Yeah. So
I want to get an actual translation, though, so I can make a note.
I'll send it to you. It's powerful. It's powerful. Anyway, that's where we are at this point. I'm in the just concluded the 13th verse of the 17th chapter, and there is just one more verse of the 17th chapter, and we transition into the 18th. So let's do that a week from today. And we'll devote the rest of the program to it. And I'll even share, promise Larry, how the last verse of the 18th chapter seemed untranslatable to me, seemed like it wasn't possible, and all of a sudden the light went off and said, oh my goodness, where do half of the Jews in the world live? Here in America. And all of a sudden, it made perfect sense. So I'll leave you with that. So there's the clue as to how to make sense of the last verse of Yashaya 18, is you realize that 42% of the world's Jews live in Israel, and 40% live in America. And that's where they're being called out of. And they are a gift brought by the Spirit for the express purpose of being able to approach Yahweh and come into His presence and meet with Him on Mount Zion. And all of a sudden you say, wow, now I know why America was mentioned. This is where half the Jews are coming from.
Yeah, but so America isn't in a very good light either.
No. In fact, there will be grotesque anti-Semitism by this point of view. So my guess is that they will be carried by the Spirit, protected by the Spirit, as they are run out of town, and they'll be run out of every country that they exist in.
Well, you know, I mean, it's
everyone
already
will blame
raging.
Them.
It's already raging. I mean, if you look, you know, everybody knows the name Rothschild. Everybody knows, you know, the name Goldman Sachs. You know, what they don't know is the Borghese's and the Orange, and the, you know, they don't even.
They're going to blame Jews for all of the terror that's going to. And when I finish this chapter, and I finish the translations, when I finish the chapter, I'm going to go back through and say, here's what God is saying is going to happen, and here's the order it's going to happen. And I'm going to use what happened in Afghanistan to show what happens after the jihadists have had their victory and they go back home. And they're going to perpetrate great acts of terror in all of these countries, and they're going to say they're doing so because those countries are, in their minds, aiding Israel, which they hate. And so the response in all of those countries is going to be, well, therefore, we need to blame the Jews, not the Muslims, for the terrorism that we have endured. Therefore, let's send all of the Jews out, and let's, as a nation, go after Israel, including America, is going to attack Israel.
The whole world does.
That's exactly what's going to happen, raging anti-Semitism. And so God's going to carry His people away. He's going to bring His people out of America so that half the world's Jewish population now is with Him in His home, and He's going to protect them there because there will be no protecting them in America.
Well, you know, the one thing I do wonder about, you know, you got this description of the guys in the flowery robes. They sound like Pope. Sounds like a Pope to me, you know, over in Zechariah.
Yeah.
And you point that out. sounds like most presidents, and sounds like a Pope as well, in their long, fancy robes. I have a feeling that the Catholic Church melds with them. Or maybe I'm wrong.
My only issue, Larry, on the Catholic Church, and then we'll say goodnight here, is that the more I study the world, and I've been fixated most recently on Macedonia, because the actual leader of Macedonia is the guy right now, the youngest leader of any European country in the world, who is both an economist, a boxer. Part of the Macedonian Orthodox Church. He's extraordinarily rich personally. He spends all of his time with the richest people in the world. This guy, his flag, his national anthem, his country, everything is a absolute perfect match for the Torahless one. He's 43 years old today. As I study Macedonia, one of the things that screams out is that there are lots of Orthodox versions of Christianity, and that Roman Catholicism, while it's the largest Orthodox Christian sect in the world, it's one of many, many, many. For example, the Macedonian Orthodox Church is a derivative of the Serbian Orthodox Church, which is a descendant of the Russian Orthodox Church, which is a breakoff of the Greek or Eastern Orthodox Church, which is Constantine's Church.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm convinced that it's that while Roman Catholicism is bad and really bad, I mean, there's lots of Christian denominations, most of which are smaller, but no less evil.
Yeah, and that's but they're all offshoots of that.
Makes sense.
Yeah, no, they're really not offshoots of Roman Catholicism. In fact, Roman Catholicism is an offshoot of the Greek Orthodox Church.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Constantine, Constantinople and Constantine was that's where he based his church, and so the church in Rome came as a derivative, as a breakoff of Constantine's.
Constantine, absolutely. Yeah,
right.
That Constantinople. Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
And Constantine's church actually became the Catholic Church. I mean,
well, since Constantine's Greek Orthodox Church still exists, and it has all these derivatives that we've talked about. One of the derivatives of Constantine's Greek Church is the Roman Catholic Church. So the Roman Catholic Church is actually derived from the Constantinian, Constantinople-based church. Because, you know, for a while, following the emperors of Rome, Rome fell. And so the only surviving aspect of Rome was in Ephesus and was in Constantinople and was in Turkey, today's Turkey. That was Rome for several hundred years, because the itself fell.
Yeah, so that's right.
When the Roman Catholic Church was conceived, and the Roman Catholic Church and the Eastern Orthodox, the Greek Orthodox Church, war with each other, particularly they were at war with each other during the Crusades, which is why they couldn't combine to create a unified force to drive the Muslims out of the Promised Land. But if you really study the history of it, the wellspring is Constantine, Constantinople, and the Greek Orthodox Church. One of the derivatives of the Greek Orthodox Church is the Roman Catholic Church, as is the Cop Church in Egypt, as is the Russian Orthodox Church, and all of these grew out of what Constantine created. So, the only reason I share that with you is that Christianity is rotten right to its beginnings, right to its core, and there's more
to
the evil.
To Paul.
Right, it's correct. Yeah, without Paul, there is no Christianity. And because of that, we truncate our understanding and our appreciation of the influences in the last days to artificially elevate the role of Roman Catholicism over all of these other machinations of Christianity, because this, if I'm right about the Torahless one being a Macedonian, which I think is likely, and even this particular fellow, he's Macedonian Orthodox, which is a derivative of the Serbian Orthodox Church, which is a derivative of the Russian Orthodox Church, which is a derivative of the Eastern Orthodox Church, which is the Greek Orthodox Church, which is Constantine's religion. So, and by the way, when you look at the guy's flag, the flag is a sun with sunbursts coming out of it. When you look at his national anthem, it sings tribute to the sun. I mean,
really?
If there was a country that was perfectly established and a leader perfectly established to be the Torahless one and the country that he's going to come from, and this interworkings between and resolutions between Islam, which tearing his country apart because there's a 25% Albanian minority in Macedonia. It's exactly as Daniel describes it. Both he and the country.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, Larry, I'm not suggesting that you view Roman Catholicism, the Jesuits, less evilly. They earn every bit of your scorn. I think the Roman Catholic Church is the single most corruptive influence in world history.
They've been raping the world for 2,000 years and blaming the Jews why they did it.
Right. But I want you to have an appreciation for the fact that the problem is much bigger than just them. Even on the Christian side, much bigger.
Oh, no, of course it is. No, I understand that. I wasn't aware of the Greek Orthodox, though, or the you know, when we're going over here to this
yeah.
neck of the woods. I mean, you're right. You're right. Constantinople served as it. That was it.
That was Rome.
Yeah, that was correct.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. That is correct. All right, my friends. Invigorating. It's been a wonderful, fun day. What a way to start the Shabbat. Personally, I think that the single most important prophecy that I've ever read for our day is in Habakkuk. It's hard to beat the one that's in Yeshaya 17 and 18 as it relates to explaining what lies in front of us.
Because we're watching that unfold before our eyes.
Yeah. By the way, the next chapter, the 19th chapter, turns to Mitzrayim, Egypt. And so it'll be interesting to see what God has to say about Egypt. And and it's also interesting that the fall of Damascus is also foretold in Yirmiyah 49. And to see how that intertwines will also be interesting. So
sounds fun.
Yeah, the whole thing's fun. I would just wish, you know, love to have more time, love to be faster at it, love to have more time. But it is fun. All right, fellas. Good night. Thank you, William. Thank you, Larry. Thank you, James.
Thank you, Adam. Uh-huh. Thank
you,
guys.
Okay. All right.
Good seventh.
See you next week.
Bye.
Happy Shabbat, everyone. Bye-bye.
Happy Shabbat. Bye.